On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. By the time Franklin Roosevelt assumed the presidency, the American economy was in a state of shock. The New York Stock Exchange was shut down. More than 5,000 banks had failed. Soup kitchens were working overtime, and the jobless rate in some cities ran as high as 80%. In the dark days of the Great Depression, not only was American capitalism imperiled, but American democracy itself was in doubt. Journalist and author Jonathan Alter writes of FDR's presidential campaign and his first 100 days, from his inaugural speech to his fireside chats to his bank bailout and the birth of Social Security. It was a new deal of hope and leadership for a nation that had lost both. Up next on Point, Jonathan Alter on FDR's defining moment. Joining me now from New York is Jonathan Alter. He's senior editor and columnist at Newsweek, and his new book is The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And Jonathan Alter, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Anthony.
It's great to have you. We're also joined from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beattie. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Anthony. And Jonathan, congratulations on this just vivid read. I just enjoyed it so much.
I really appreciate that. I love your books on politics, so it's high praise.
Well, Jonathan, let me second Jack's praise. It is vivid reading and a wonderful sense of who this man was and the times that he lived in, and that's where I wanted to start this conversation. Give us a sense, if you would, of just how desperate the times were in America when FDR came on the scene. I mean, the Depression wasn't just an economic collapse. You write that the very ideas of American capitalism and democracy were in peril.
That's right. You know, this was the bottom of the Great Depression, the winter of 1932-33. But people didn't know it was the bottom. They thought at the time that it could go lower still. So if you lived in, say, Toledo, Ohio, where unemployment was 80%, maybe it would go to 90%. Hmm. You didn't know. If you had put your money in a bank that went bust, and 10,000 banks did so, you were done. You were finished. It didn't matter whether you had gone to Harvard or, you know, were working class or whatever. All you had left was what you might have stuffed under the mattress. So people were in a mental depression that was every bit as severe as the economic depression. Essentially, the country was curled up in the fetal position. And then when the state started closing even the healthy banks and declaring these what FDR later festively called bank holidays, Hoover preferred to call them moratoriums, and they would close the banks in those states, then we were at the time that Roosevelt came to office, and for the first week that he was in office, we were on essentially a barter economy, so that you would, if you wanted to go to, say, a boxing match in New York, you'd bring an old pair of shoes or maybe some old neckties, and they would have New York City policemen who were in front of the Golden Gloves entrance. And they would decide whether that was worth the 25 cents admission. And that's how people got by.
You write that in these desperate times, there was talk of dictatorship was in the air, that more than a few people were saying what America needs is a figure like Mussolini, who at that time was regarded by many as an impressive leader who brought the kind of discipline and reform to Italy that was very much needed. And there was serious talk of dictatorship.
Yes, this was one of the big surprises for me, is that the word dictator at that time, not even a year later it changed, but in 1933 it was a positive word, and not just some fascists in the United States believed in dictatorship. Walter Lippmann, the pillar of the American establishment, the famous columnist, actually said to Roosevelt a couple weeks before he took office, "Franklin, you may have to assume dictatorial powers." Even Eleanor thought that we might need a benevolent dictator for a time. And many, many politicians and other leaders, including Al Smith, the former governor of New York, thought that we should just put the Constitution on the shelf for a while. And William Randolph Hearst made a movie called Gabriel Over the White House, starring Walter Huston, John's father, Angelica's grandfather, in which he instructed Roosevelt on how to be a benevolent, not so benevolent dictator. The hero of the movie, the president in the movie, is a dictator who lines up his enemies in front of the firing squad, and everybody cheers. Roosevelt actually worked a little bit on the screenplay and wrote to Hearst that he thought it would help him very much. And he was tempted on taking office to establish a Mussolini-type private army. I found a document that hadn't surfaced before that showed that
he was advised to do so. This is a speech that was he never delivered, correct? He was on the verge of
giving
this to the veterans of foreign wars. And tell us
the
about
American
this.
Legion.
Sorry, the American Legion. Tell us about this document.
Well, it was really my eyes kind of popped out at the Roosevelt Library when I saw this because somebody, and I don't know who wrote it, recommended that for this radio address, which he gave on his very first full day in office, March 5th, 1933, that he basically told the veterans that they would report to him and that he could order them to do anything necessary during the crisis. And this is what Mussolini had done with the black shirts in Italy. Hitler was new. He had just won an election consolidating his power that very weekend, that very day, as a matter of fact. And so no, people thought of him as a buffoon. Within a few months, dictator took on a really negative connotation. Mm-hmm. But at that time, there was great interest in dictatorial powers. FDR decided not to do it, and he passed word on Capitol Hill, forget Walter Lippmann, I'm not going to be a dictator. And so my book is really about how he substituted his persuasive abilities, his incandescent leadership for the sword or for a government by fiat. And he did everything quite legally, no constitutional amendments or anything like that during the greatest economic crisis in American history.
Well, I want to talk more about all of that, but let's get a sense of Roosevelt, the voice of Roosevelt. We've got a recording from his first inaugural, March 4th, 1933, which began a love affair between this president and much of his public.
President Hoover, Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And that is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his first inaugural speech, March 4th, 1933. Jonathan Alter, you write about that, the famous line, nothing to fear but fear itself. You write that in terms of policy proposals, the speech was pretty weak and nonspecific. And you write that that famous line was a specimen of inspired nonsense because, of course, there was lots of things to fear at the time. But it had a huge impact on this nation. Why?
A huge impact. I mean, I was just trying to explain to people that if you have to fear how you're going to put food on the table for your children, that's a real fear. It's not fear itself. So that's why I called it inspired nonsense. But, of course, it was a brilliant speech, and it began to lift people out of their depression, even though the economic depression didn't end for another 7 years. But he began this astonishing conjuring act with that speech. the very first line, this is a day of national consecration, he wrote just moments before going to be sworn in the Capitol, just a few minutes before giving the speech. And I found that quite interesting because, you know, Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg said, we shall not, we cannot consecrate. He did not, even at Gettysburg, he didn't want to give a sort of religious significance to the dedication of that cemetery, whereas Roosevelt feels that he needs to essentially turn his own swearing in into a rite, almost a quasi-religious rite. But what it really was for me was a tremendous act of theater. So, you know, the notion of the willing suspension of disbelief that you need for great theater or great fiction. That's what that line, "the only thing we have to fear is fear itself," did. It began that new sense of hope, even though it was not the big applause line in the speech. It was not on the front page of most newspapers the next day. It was on the inside pages. And the real applause came when he said that he would assume wartime powers, essentially dictatorial powers, if necessary.
I want you to give a sense of what Roosevelt was up against in terms of the general consensus of that time about the role of government. And I guess what I'm driving at here is today we debate the role of how much government should help, but it was very different then. I mean, this whole idea that government actually had a role to bail people out like this.
Absolutely. You know, during Hurricane and after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of debate. Did President Bush respond fast enough? Who was to blame? Nobody, even on the far right, said that it was not the responsibility of Washington and the president to help come to the aid of people who were drowning in a flood. Hmm. And before what I call the defining moment, before Franklin Roosevelt rewrote the social contract or rewrote the idea of what we owe each other as a people, introduced the notion that we're all in this together, before that, at the time he became president, there were many, many prominent people in the U.S. Congress and throughout the country who believed if you were starving, that was your problem. And maybe some voluntary efforts could be of help, but it was simply none of government's concern if you were in trouble. Mm. And that's a pretty big change that he was responsible for.
Jack Beatty, is that the change that resonates most for you as you look through Jonathan Alter's book and hear the voice all these years later of Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Yes, you know, government changed owners. He once wrote to Louis Howe, his secretary, confidant, and really one of his few intimates, that he said, you know, the financial centers of this country have pretty much owned the government for a long, long time, and I'm not accepting the administration of WW, meaning Woodrow Wilson. Well, the government changed owners. The people, finally, had a government that would respond to them. And, you know, the philosophy of the Democratic Party, Wilson accepted, had really been do nothing. It had been Grover Cleveland in the 19th century said, you know, government doesn't owe anything to the people. The people owe things to the government. Well, this was a whole reversal. And the idea that the government has a responsibility, but more than that, that it is an ally of people, that the government can work for people. He was once asked, well, what's the philosophy of the New Deal? And he said one word, security. And he said, you know, we've all had to take too many chances in our lives. We've had to take chances with sickness, chances with unemployment, chances with old age. And he said, I think we've taken too many chances. We shouldn't have to take that many chances. And this basic idea that people needed a cushioning against the vicissitudes of the economy and indeed of mortality and illness, this basic idea was a revolutionary in American government.
Mm. Jonathan Alter, Jack Beatty raises this idea of what exactly the New Deal was. Was it a philosophy? Was it or was it a set of specific social programs?
It was not a set of specifics. You know, Raymond Moley, who was FDR's top aide at the beginning, said that to say that the New Deal was a fixed plan was like saying that a boy's bedroom full of old dirty clothes and broken baseball bats and old pennants that had been all put there by an interior decorator. So this was a real seat-of-the-pants improvisational effort. But as Jack indicates, there was a vision there, and this was a vision of a world, in FDR's words, that where people were secured against, quote, the winds of chance and the hurricanes of disaster. And he understood that fate could take some pretty unfortunate twists for people. And he started to really understand that at Warm Springs when he met all of these other polio sufferers who couldn't cushion themselves as well as he could because he had money. And I think that really deepened him. And I spend quite a bit of time in the book trying to explain how polio really shaped his vision.
Hmm. Let's take a call, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join the conversation with Jonathan Alter about FDR. Alice is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello, Alice.
Hi. I was there for the Depression. Looking back, I think it did me some good. But the point I want to make is that we all felt we were in this together, where it was a level playing field, no matter what our status. And also, we had more respect for just the office of the president. But I never knew that Roosevelt was a cripple because the press was kinder to him, I guess.
Interesting. Alice, thanks so much for the call. Jonathan Alter, the idea of being in it all together. I mean, it sounds like Alice is speaking for a generation that was really touched by that Roosevelt magic.
Absolutely. And actually, the most interesting thing for me, I've just returned from a 10-city book tour, and the number of older Americans who come up, and even if they were quite young when FDR died, they all remember exactly where they were when they heard the news that he had died. They talk about how he saved their parents' house or their father's job. And, you know, a lot of them, I mean, it was a perfectly good seller for Mother's Day and Father's Day. But I've been much more struck by how many people have me inscribe the book to their children and grandchildren because they want the current generation and future generations to know what it was like to be in the presence of great leadership, and that people feel disconnected from leadership right now. And there was a time when we had it, and that's what I at least tried to capture in this book.
I want to talk to you a little bit about his fireside chats, and in a moment, in fact, we have a little bit of tape to play from his first fireside chat. This was the first time a president was able to use the power of radio to reach tens of millions of Americans. How did he come across on the radio, and why were these radio addresses so effective?
Well, the first fireside chat really revolutionized communications. You played a clip from Bing Crosby. Roosevelt did for speaking what Bing Crosby did for singing. Interestingly, that Brother, Can You Spare a Dime was written when Herbert Hoover wanted a song to cheer people up at the end of his time in office, and that's what they came up with. But Roosevelt's voice reflected his understanding of the fact that the microphone had been invented. Before that, for thousands of years, because the technology wasn't there, leaders spoke to their people like this in a very stentorian way. Mm-hmm. And they had to speak loudly to reach the back of the auditorium. And, you know, some politicians still talk that way. I think you probably can name them. But Roosevelt understood that you could create this different sort of relationship and that you could have a conversation. Now, what do they pay the big bucks in television and radio for? People who sound conversational. And I would argue that he was really the first one who got that. He was looking out the window of the Oval Office in the first week of his presidency, and he saw a workman taking down the scaffolding from his inauguration. And he said to himself, he later recalled, I'm going to write a radio speech about banking that fellow can understand. And he did with some help.
Well, let's listen to that, Jonathan. We've got it right here, that very speech, March 12th, 1933. It was his first fireside chat.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking, to talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be.
We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system,
and it is up to you to support and make it work. It is your problem, my friends. Your problem no less than it is mine. Together, we cannot fail.
There's President Franklin Roosevelt, his first fireside chat on March 12, 1933. Jonathan Alter, my friends, I want to talk to you about banking. And his friends listened to him, didn't they?
Yes, those were really revolutionary words for a leader to call people my friends. Now, you could go back, you know, to Mark Antony in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar and friends Roman countrymen, but usually that's not the level of discourse that leaders had with their people. And the effect of this speech was astonishing. The same Americans who just a couple weeks earlier had been elbowing each other out of the way to get to the front of the line, to bang on the doors of their banks in these terrifying bank runs, to get what little money might be left out. Now, after hearing Roosevelt on the radio, they lined up to patriotically take their money out from under the mattress and redeposit it. Now, if you can get people to change their behavior that way, that's real leadership. But he also understood that it wasn't enough, that talk was not enough. And so that night when he got back to the Oval Office after giving that speech, he said, I think it's time for some beer. and they speeded passage of legalization of beer, and then they had full repeal of prohibition by the end of the year. And he understood that there were a lot of different ways that you had to raise people's spirits, and there were 15 major pieces of legislation that just transformed this country that were all passed in the first 100 days.
Mm. Jack Beatty, what do you hear in FDR's voice all these years later? My friends, I want to talk to you about banking. It was a real genuine connection, wasn't it?
It was, and it got through. Someone, I think David Kennedy in his book on FDR, tells of someone seeing a boxcar in the rail yards at Denver, upon the side of which a hobo, I guess you could call it, or a traveler, or a rail rider, had scrawled, FDR is our friend. Now think of that. Mm. Someone penniless on the road puts on the boxcar that the President of the United States is our friend. And I thought of that recently, listening to a wonderful piece of reporting on NPR by Julie Rovner on Tennessee and the problem they're having there with having to cut, they're cutting people off health care. And there was a woman who subsisted on $600 a month, lived in a wheelchair, took care of her grandchildren, and basically had to choose among taking heart medicine or medicine that would prevent her from being incontinent. And so she took the incontinence and lived in a pad. Mm. Couldn't go out on that account. $600 a month. And I thought, no one is saying, you know, is that right? I mean, is she going to scrawl on the boxcar, George Bush is my friend, or the governor? Is not likely that basic idea of people, of getting a helping hand, it's gone by the board.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to talk about the kind of leadership that FDR represented. Let's go to David, who's calling from Danbury, Connecticut.
Yes, hi. Hello. FDR certainly was a big fan of mine. And one thing I was always impressed with Roosevelt was how he lifted the country up by the Works Progress Administration. And today I still believe that this could be utilized in our country because of what it gave. It wasn't just a handout. It helped their morality in the sense that they created things that still stand today. My father and I have taken my daughter also to some stone walls along the reservoir erected by the WPA. I've shown my daughter so she can appreciate what took place in our country, or a town beach area where the stone walls were built. There's lasting efforts of that era. Hmm. We have nothing that we can always see today are canceled checks from handouts that are given. What do you think about having a WPA once again?
Jonathan Alter, WPA, could it happen again?
Well, I think if unemployment gets to a certain point, I think we might see it again. FDR didn't really believe in the dole. He believed in jobs and putting people to work. And it started with the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, where in the first week in office, FDR said, I want a quarter of a million young men working, doing conservation, planting trees. Eventually, they planted 3 billion trees. And he said, I want this to start by summer. And everybody on his staff and his cabinet told him it was impossible. But he knew enough about the gearing of government to get it done. Eventually, 3 million served. And that became the template for the WPA and a number of other jobs programs. It built thousands of schools, thousands of roads, thousands of hospitals. Pretty much if you drive around whatever major city you live near, the bridges and the tunnels, many of them were built in this period. So not only did it put people to work, but it built the infrastructure of the United States. And it did hundreds of other things that we don't even think about. I mean, the CCC, for instance, and Roosevelt didn't know this, but they cut what became the first ski trails in the United States. So a paralyzed president was responsible for the American ski industry, among thousands of other things. And he did it all with very little corruption, a lot of accountability. And that's where Eleanor Roosevelt was extremely helpful, because she would travel around and she'd say, you know, the WPA is not working in this city or that city. I mean, they got the wrong administrator in there. And they would make these mid-course corrections. And I would argue that the lack of mid-course corrections and admission of error and mistake is one of our big problems today. And they'd make these changes because FDR believed in what he called bold, persistent experimentation. Take one method and try it. If it doesn't work, admit failure frankly and try another. Hmm. But above all, try something. So that was his guiding philosophy, was to keep working the problem.
FDR as a great leader. It wasn't necessarily a given, though, was it? I mean, in the early going, even through his campaign, he was described by people like Walter Lippmann as a political lightweight. I mean, this is someone who sort of rose to the occasion, as opposed to convincing a nation that he was the one that could handle this crisis.
That's absolutely right. I mean, even at the time he was elected, it was seen as an anti-Herbert Hoover vote, not a pro-FDR vote. And he was seen as weak, unprincipled, a flip-flopper. He was for the League of Nations before he was against it. He wasn't a wet on prohibition or dry. He was a damp. You know, he thought it should be left up to the states, and people thought that was really irresponsible, that he wouldn't take positions. They thought he was kind of a conniving politician, which in many respects he was. I mean, my book is very much sort of warts and all, because I'm interested in how he used some of his manipulative abilities to good effect. But what I try to tell people is that if they had been voters in 1932 during the Democratic primaries, and they had a few in those days, it's very unlikely that most of them would have voted for Franklin Roosevelt. He was the sort of smart money was not behind him, and it was only through a series of really unusual manipulations that he was able to secure a victory on the fourth ballot in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. And so this notion that somehow you know, he descended from the heavens, this kind of marbleized notion of FDR, I try to deconstruct without debunking him.
But this weakness, this idea of sort of political weakness and flip-flopping, you write that it sort of became his strength in the sense that he was flexible. He was politically supple.
Yes, and that is absolutely critical, Anthony, because to me that is one of the big differences between Franklin Roosevelt and George W. Bush, even though they come from similar backgrounds. And, you know, I've got a lot about Roosevelt's mother, and she was very strong, like Barbara Bush, and a lot of similarities before they became president, including both men were called lightweights. But once they got to office, they responded in completely different fashion. And the key thing is what you said, that Roosevelt was supple, flexible. He was extraordinarily open-minded, and even though he was not an intellectual by any means, Herbert Hoover had a much, much higher IQ. FDR was tremendously intellectually curious, so he was always sopping up a lot of information and then cross-checking it with different—he didn't trust any experts in particular. He was always playing off his people against each other. And then, as I indicated, Eleanor would travel around the country by coach. Can you imagine a first lady traveling coach class? And she would deliver these quite brilliant dispatches into the inbox next to her husband's bed that would, you know, tell him how to be even more open-minded and how to change things that weren't working.
Quite an evolution for Eleanor, too, because you write, I mean, I didn't know about this. I mean, I knew that she was this terrific political partner for FDR, but she wept on election night at the prospect of having to become a White House, a first lady, and serve teas. I mean, she hated the idea, didn't she?
Hated, loathed the idea of becoming a first lady. During the convention, she actually wrote a friend threatening to run away with her bodyguard from Albany and blow up FDR's political career. But then, partly with the help of her great friend Lorena Hickok, to whom she drew very close in this period, she sort of reimagined the role of First Lady and started to hold press conferences, write a newspaper column, go down into coal mines and, you know, do all the things that we associate with Eleanor Roosevelt. And that was all happening in this first 100 days also.
Yeah, Jack, I wanted to bring you in this conversation about political suppleness and the sort of flexibility that Roosevelt displayed.
Yes, and I think John puts his finger on it. Curiosity. He asked people questions. He was secure enough to ask people questions, which assume you don't know the answer. I.F. Stone told me, the journalist told me, that when you covered Roosevelt, when you went into the Oval Office to cover one of his press conferences, they're all off the record, usually off the record, Roosevelt asked more questions than the reporters. Someone would be there from the Minneapolis Star and he'd say, "What's going on with the Pillsbury Company out there? Tell me what the situation is." And he would debrief the reporter. This was a man who just was tremendously avid of information. And, you know, there the contrast with Bush is stark. In his memoir, Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, said when he presented the economic plan to the president right after the inauguration, Bush didn't have a single question. When he was given the plan to attack America, there was no question. When he was apparently in the planning for Iraq, there was no question about what happens the day after. Bush is not secure enough to ask a question. Franklin Roosevelt he didn't know the answers. He had intelligent people around him who did. And there's another thing. This guy didn't appoint political hacks.
Let's take a call. Yeah. Walter is calling from Littleton, Massachusetts. Hi, Walter.
Hi.
What's on your mind? Thanks for the call.
Very quickly, I want to make sure that everyone was not aware that a large number of particularly business people did not think too well of FDR. I'm thinking of my father, a very mild-mannered man, yet he made it clear to we children that we cannot bring up FDR's name at the dinner table or he'd fly into a rage. And so it was with his friends. They thought that FDR was taking the nation to hell faster than you can imagine, particularly during the NRA and some of those things. I don't share my father's view, but I think it's important that we realize there was a great number of business people who despised the man.
Absolutely, Walter. I'm really grateful that you bring that up. It's true, Jonathan, isn't it? I mean, he was a traitor to his class.
Yes, he
engendered
he was.
Very strong feelings both for him and against him.
Yes. The thing that's so peculiar about that, though, is that, I argue that FDR actually saved capitalism in this early period when a lot of people, and even the head of the Harvard Business School, thought that capitalism might be at an end. And in his first weeks in office, they came to him, the other New Dealers, and said, "You must nationalize the banks." And the whole country was for nationalizing the banks. And then the fallback position of the so-called brain trust was post office banks. Can you imagine if the patronage-ridden post office had taken over banks? FDR said no, and he went with the conservative Hoover holdover view that banking should be kept in private hands. And so he saved the fortunes of people like the caller's father. And then but just a few years later, they all despised him. And FDR himself was a little bit annoyed by this, and he compared it to the lifeguard who saves a drowning man in a silk hat. And then 4 years later, the man he saved comes back and says to him, "Hey, where's my hat?" And that there was this great ingratitude on the part of the wealthy, partly for some good reasons, because not everything FDR did was right. The caller mentioned the National Recovery Administration, and this was a real mess. It was regulation run completely amok. They actually, hard to believe, but they actually regulated from Washington the burlesque industry to the point where bureaucrats would determine how many times a night a stripper could take off her clothes. So, you know, some of this was out of hand, and he did not have a good what we would now call a growth agenda. But I mostly agree with Roosevelt that the dominant idea as far as the resentment of American business is concerned is simple ingratitude.
Let's go to Leah, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hello, Leah.
Hello. Hi, Anthony.
Thank you for the call. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind? My love for Roosevelt. Well, I listened to him when I was 13, and I thought God had come on this earth. But most significantly, it was through the NYA, National Youth Administration, $15 a month, I was able to go to college in California. You could go to junior college for $5. You could go to UCLA for $16 and Cal for $16. And it was knowing that money was coming in, even though I was starving most of the time. I went through 6 years of college and got my master's in social work. He also introduced artistic things, the plays. We could go to plays for a quarter. He had artists paint on the walls of buildings. Diego Rivera even painted some murals. And in San Francisco, they have Court Tower, and you walk up there, and all the walls are painted with fantastic murals of the history of California.
Well, Leah, thanks so much for these recollections. They paint a fuller picture of FDR and his legacy, don't they, Jonathan Alter? I mean, great
absolutely.
To hear what Leah's talking about.
And there are so many stories like that and so many people who later changed the country. For instance, Lyndon Johnson came out of the NYA. And in terms of, you know, what was done for theater and for painting, we're still benefiting from the legacy of that. There's a Clifford Odets play on Broadway right now. So FDR himself had very unsophisticated tastes in art, mostly favored naval prints. But as one painter said, you know, he did more for artists by far than any other president, and more for young people in terms of giving them a sense of hope. I mean, that's why, you know, the subtitle of the defining moment, the one that we chose was, you know, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And I think we really heard that in the caller's voice, is that people who were desperate and had given up were just given a little leg up, and it restored their hope and faith and their ability to lead a productive life.
Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Rutland, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's on your mind?
Mr. Alter, I'm enjoying your book very much. I'm
Thank you.
Not through with it yet, but I'm certainly am glad I picked it up, and it's a good read. You mention in the book relationship between Al Smith and FDR, and it seems as if Al Smith's treatment of FDR was not really abusive, but I would characterize it close to that, where FDR seems to have idolized him. Could you go into that a little bit more? And could you tell me whether that influenced FDR's first 100 days?
And yeah, then yeah, and Jonathan, be sure to give us some background for those who might not know the whole story about who Al Smith is and so forth.
Al Smith was probably the greatest governor in the history of the state of New York. He came from the Lower East Side, and he was a tremendously colorful political personality. You know, you remember the old New York accent, you know, Toity Toid and Toid Street, the Pison, you know, that's the way Al Smith talked. He was nominated for president in 1928, and FDR placed his name in nomination in both 1924 and 28, and he lost to Hoover. He was the first Catholic ever nominated, and it was assumed that they were close friends, and they sort of pretended to be in public. In fact, from the time they first met each other in 1911, they really didn't like each other very much. And it was a relationship of convenience that after Roosevelt was elected governor in 1928, and when Smith was leaving the governorship and failing to become president, it really turned bitter. And then Smith did everything he could to keep Roosevelt from becoming president. And most of the opposition to Roosevelt in 1932 was engineered by Smith, who was jealous and just didn't want him to be president. Can you imagine that they kept – Roosevelt was the governor of New York, and yet his people like Jim Farley and his other campaign managers, they couldn't even get seats in the New York delegation to the convention. Hmm. Can you imagine Karl Rove not getting a seat in the Texas delegation? You know, so Smith did everything he could to stop him, and then eventually, they had a kind of a very chilly reconciliation for the purposes of beating Hoover. And then Roosevelt didn't give him a job. He might have at least liked to have been asked to be ambassador to Great Britain or some kind of posting. And Roosevelt completely stiffed him when he became president. Smith, who felt that Roosevelt was playing class warfare, kind of anticipating a lot of the arguments that Republicans would make in later years, was moving to the right, and he helped found something called the Liberty League early on, which rallied opposition to FDR. And he once said, Franklin threw me out the window, which really wasn't quite true. But there was each man had a kind of a chip on his shoulder, and it was almost snob versus reverse snob is the way each perceived the other.
Interesting. Paul, thanks for that call. Jonathan Alter, I want to ask you this, and we're very close to out of time, so it'll have to be a brief answer, but the media has changed so much since Roosevelt days and the relationship between the media and the White House. I'm wondering if you think any 21st century presidential candidate, even someone with the kind of potential that FDR had, would be allowed the same kind of success in today's political Washington.
I think there are a lot of misconceptions about this. Reporters liked FDR a lot, in part because he had two press conferences a week. Can you imagine? They got to go in the Oval Office and talk to him twice a week. And you know, now if we have three or four a year, it's a lot. So reporters liked him, but the publishers hated him. And there were vicious columns against him, Stalin, Delano Roosevelt, the raw deal. Sometimes you'd even see in the papers they'd call it the Jew deal. Was really venomous stuff. So this idea that everything was kind of patty cake then and rough now is I don't think is right. His polio was known. The idea that that was a secret is not true. What was hidden from the public was the extent of his disability. And so there were no pictures of him in a wheelchair, even though he used one every day. And that obviously wouldn't happen nowadays. But I think today FDR would just go on Oprah, you know, and he'd just talk about it candidly, and it would go over just fine. And I think he would be a very successful president today for some of the reasons that Jack indicated and you indicated, Anthony, before, his suppleness and flexibility and great vision.
Well, Jonathan Alter, thanks so much for a great account of an amazing time and a wonderful portrait of leadership. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Anthony.
Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek magazine and author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Graham Griffith. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.